key with nothing to open has no purpose. Josh felt it rattle against Boone's tobacco tin in his pocket. Through the narrow window he caught a glimpse of that eerie blue-white flickering light as it swelled. He hesitated, caught in indecision, frozen between throwing the door open and running, or shrinking back into the shadows of the shed and pulling the old blanket up over his head and hoping the wraith bride just passed him by. That hesitation took the choice out of his hands. Josh saw her through the cobwebbed glass, heart-stoppingly beautiful and utterly terrifying, as she ghosted across the foxtails, dandelion clocks, and seed potatoes toward the shed. He scuffed back a step away from the glass, his foot fetching up against a discarded flower box and making it scrape across the wooden floor with what, given as he was trying to be church mouse silent, sounded to him like enough of a racket to raise the dead. Josh fervently prayed she hadn't heard it. Mind racing, he ducked away from the window. How had she followed him here? How had she known this was where he would run to when he hadn't known himself? Or, more pertinently, perhaps, more bitterly, certainly, how had he been stupid enough to allow himself to be cornered here with nowhere to run? The air felt peculiar. It was as if it was heavy with energy, charged. He risked a careful step back toward Boone's makeshift chair, transferring his weight from one foot to another, very, very carefully, so the old boards beneath them didn't protest, and then another, putting him out of direct line of sight through the window. He could hear her out there, moving through the allotment. He could hear the rustle of her long white dress through the high foxtails, and the whisper of the long grasses in her wake. And he could hear something else, too, even if he couldn't understand what. A burst of static, like a radio that had fallen off station, a cackle of white noise as it tried to retune, and somewhere inside that, the ghosts of voices that couldn't quite come through. The shed was filled with an array of makeshift weapons, if worst came to worst, but he wasn't sure he could fight the woman. Could a rusty old sickle cut her? He didn't want to ever find out the answer. That didn't stop him from taking down the sickle. It didn't have a particularly good edge on it, but given that the last thing he wanted to do was swing it, the lack of cutting edge really wasn't a deal-breaker. The diffuse blue light filled the window, casting shadows across the workbench and tools inside the shed, as it created a stark new geography for the place that consisted of black shadows and sharp angles. He caught a glimpse of her blonde bob through the glass as she crossed the window. The static crackled again. It was at the door. The eerie light crept beneath it, seeming to edge closer and closer to his feet, reaching out for him. Josh tried to shuffle back another step, but there was nowhere to go. The handle rattled. Josh could half hear the voices trapped inside it as another burst of static filled the night. His grip tightened on the sickle's wooden grip. The handle turned. The door groaned open an inch. Two. The Wraith Bride's weird luminescence spilled into the shed. The light touched every corner of the interior. There was nowhere to hide as she opened the door. Myrna Shepherd stood in the doorway, the folds of her white dress coiling around her, her chest flushed, rising and falling shallowly, breath coming fast. Her eyes were smoky hollows. She opened her mouth and another burst of white noise and ghost voices crackled out of her. He heard words in there. They were faint, coming from a long way away. Another time, another place. And they made no sense to him.
Gimme a whiskey sour.
What do you want from me?
Gimme a whiskey sour.
Josh didn't know what to say to that.
I don't have any,
Josh said, feeling stupid and terrified at the same time. It was beyond surreal, facing a movie icon in the doorway of his grandfather's allotment shed, listening to her ask for a drink, and knowing what she really wanted was to shred his soul. His free hand closed around the key in his pocket. All he could think was that he couldn't let her have it.
Come on, baby. You don't want to disappoint a lady. do you?
I can't give you what I don't have.
Josh took his hand out of his pocket and held up both the sickle and the empty hand to show Shepherd he wasn't holding out on her.
You don't want to disappoint a lady.
She crossed the threshold, just a single step. And then she stopped, tilting her head as though listening to something. A sound so far away or pitched so high, he couldn't hear. Her face twitched, her head straightened. Those smoky eyes of hers bore into him. Her nostrils flared, and then her entire face flickered, and for the silence between his hammering heartbeats, she wasn't there. And then she was. Another burst of static filled with words, an old movie line, he realized, hearing the echo of that famous statement of hers.
Loneliness is good for the soul.
And, good to her word, the thing that was Myrna Shepherd backed away from the door, leaving Josh Raines to stand there and stare at the open doorway, and wonder what had just happened, and how the hell he was still alive. He didn't move for a full 5 minutes, but the light had long since faded. Whatever she wasn't coming back. He didn't know what had stopped her, but whatever the reason, it had saved his life, so he wasn't about to start arguing with it. He dropped the sickle on the old workbench and sank down onto Boone's tea-chest seat, exhausted as the flood of adrenaline left his body. He was shaking so hard the key in his pocket rattled against the tobacco tin, as though to remind him it was still there. When is a key not a key? He riddled himself again. Only he did know what it opened, just not where it opened it. It opened the door to Boone's secret place. He even knew what was inside it, or at least thought he did. It couldn't be far away. He knew that, too. The old man hadn't traveled much in his last days. So in point of fact, he knew a lot more than he had even a few hours ago. And he wasn't fumbling in the dark. Boone had left him Isaiah's confession for a reason, hadn't he? It had to be a clue, didn't it? But there were no addresses in that old letter, were there? 10. Wraith Bride. Taff Carter felt particularly pleased with himself as he arrived home that night. He'd got one over on those smug bastards. They'd been so sure he'd do anything for the money, and truth be told, he probably would have, if he hadn't had to put up with Lockwood's brat calling him a bent bastard, like he was somehow better. How could a piece of scum like Lockwood think he ever had the moral high ground? The man was worse than the shit you dragged in on the bottom of your shoe. But that only made his little victory all the sweeter. Taff slammed the car door, and damn it if he wasn't whistling as he walked the short distance down the driveway to his front door. If any of the neighbors had heard him mangling that happy tune, they'd have assumed he was drunk or stoned. Taff might have been many things, but he was not a whistler. He glanced back over his shoulder as he put the key in the lock. The habit was ingrained. Trust no one. You never knew who was out there, or who might have followed you home. Better safe than sorry, and a dozen other little pat truisms. He'd given the speech 100 times at victim support meetings. It was all about taking responsibility for your own safety. He was alone. He opened the door and went inside. The house was quiet. It was always quiet. That's what came of living alone. It would have been nice to be one of those guys who came home from work to the smells of cooking in the kitchen and the bustle of kids running up and down the stairs, toys everywhere, the family dog jumping up and down excitedly. But that life wasn't for him. He'd accepted the truth of that years ago. He'd never been a ladies' man, and even when he had managed to find someone who liked him enough to say yes, he'd never learned the secret of making it last. He turned the lights on and locked the door behind him. Home sweet home. He had his routines. Through to the lounge to put some music on. Miles Davis tonight. Kind of Blue, accompanying him through to the kitchen to brew a pot of coffee, before getting out of the uniform and kicking back for an hour just unwinding. Davis's melancholic sax was perfect for his mood. There was something inherently lonely about it. It was the music of solitude. It was also the soundtrack of his life. The fragrance of freshly ground coffee beans filled the kitchen. Taff kicked off his shoes and sank down into the couch. He wasn't a bent bastard, whatever they said. He wasn't even a bad cop. He'd started out as an idealist, just like Julie Gennaro, full of spit and vinegar. He'd gone toe-to-toe with some of the biggest villains in the city and won, or at least hadn't lost, which was an important distinction in this day and age. And then that bastard Lockwood had found his Achilles heel, and just like that he was in his pocket, and no matter how much he wriggled and struggled and kicked back, he just couldn't get out now. He was too far gone. So it stopped being about getting out, and became about taking the money, keeping his head down, not getting caught. He wasn't proud of what he'd become, but Taff Carter was a survivor. He'd live with the shame. And his vice? Drink. Drugs. Sex. No, no, and no. Gambling? No. No cards, no ponies, no big game rollovers. He didn't even play the lottery. He was a mother's boy. She was in a nursing home, bills spiraling and threatening to get out of control because her treatment was so expensive. It had started out at 600 quid a week, that became 770 within 2 months, and that was better than the 900 it had been for the last 11 months. A letter had arrived that morning extorting another 150 quid out of him a week that he simply didn't have, putting her care at 1,050 quid a week. And that treatment only amounted to waiting for her to die. But that was the money-grabbing Tories running the country for you, with their health panels and care councils, and everything else that made them money, and cost guys like Taff everything they had. They'd started taxing bedrooms and God knows what else in their austerity program, and sent good people to food banks to survive, while giving themselves big fat pay raises. It was a new, ugly world they were living in, where profit mattered more than life. He worked extra shifts, pounding the beat all hours God sent. It wasn't enough. He just wound up feeling guilty as the dementia claimed her deeper by the day. She didn't recognize him when he went to see her, so he stopped going to see her. But he kept paying for her like a good son, even as it cleaned him out. Of course, he should have declared it to the suits higher up the food chain. That was his mistake. When Gideon Lockwood had offered to see his old mum right, make sure she was taken care of, how could he say no? He closed his eyes and listened to the music, waiting for the woman to come. Lockwood had promised him she would, and one thing the Lockwoods were good for was their word. The music swelled, filling his mind until there was nothing else in the world to think about, only the cascading notes, over 14 minutes worth of them. It regulated his breathing. If he'd been a smoker, he would have had a cigarette as the song ended, like some post-coital ritual, with John Coltrane's haunting tenor sax not playing so much as sighing its way through blue and green. He didn't have long to wait. She didn't knock at the door or ring the bell. The first he knew of her presence in his two-bedroomed terraced house was the cold chill that accompanied the eerie luminescence as the Wraith Bride's light touched his skin. He opened his eyes. She was beautiful. More beautiful, if that were possible, than he remembered from their brief encounter. Her face belonged to that rare and precious breed, capable of driving a man to the depths of despair and the heights of covetousness in the silence between breaths. He envied the Lockwoods their hold over the city, their ability to get anyone to dance to their tune. Even a woman as stunning as this to come and fuck a fat man like him, just because they said so. "Tell me your name," Taff Carter said, looking up at her. She didn't say a word. She reached down for his knees and parted them, and knelt between his legs. He squirmed beneath her silent touch. Somehow she conveyed so much raw sexuality without uttering a single word. Not for her the boorish entreaties to, "Fuck me now, I want you inside me," or any of those other 50 shades. She was too classy for that, just as he'd known she would be. And no matter what Lockwood has said, he couldn't believe this was just business. Not the way she looked up at him with her smoldering eyes, as she traced her fingers across his zipper and teased it down. He trembled beneath her touch, chewing at his lower lip. Taff reached out to tangle his fingers in her hair. He wanted to savor this moment, this victory. He wanted to enjoy it. Fuck that. He wanted to revel in it as she took him into her mouth. He wanted to own her, just like Lockwood owned him. He wanted to win for once, just once. He gasped and grabbed a fistful of her hair as she went down on him, throwing his head back so hard it hit the wall behind him. He couldn't think. Every muscle in his body was taut. Taff opened his eyes again as he clenched his fist. The suddenness of it tore at her hair. He couldn't help himself. He wanted to see everything, to burn it onto his mind forever, because he knew this was a once-in-a-lifetime thing. But the agony and the ecstasy of it combined was too much for him. His head went back again, and he closed his eyes as he gasped a, "My God!" up toward the ceiling. But there was no God for a man like Taff Carter. Not here. She climbed up him, her hands on his arms, taking her weight, until they were eye to eye. He couldn't focus on her. She flickered uncontrollably, blurring before his eyes before coming back into sharp focus. There was nothing romantic about the look she gave him. It was pure appetite. She opened her mouth again, a burst of white noise shredding the silence of the room. There were words in it, he was sure, like before, promises that reached all the way down to the core of his being and promised him devotion, desire, and eventually the gentle release of death.
"Tell me your name," he begged her, as she reached up to place both of her hands on either side of his head, fingers pressing a little too hard, a little too hungrily, into his temples.
She said nothing. She traced her thumbnails across his eyes. She traced her fingernails around his temples. She moved against him, taking him deeper. And this was all he'd ever wanted. This was better than money. This was worth losing his soul for. How could Lockwood even question it? And he held on to that thought as he looked at her, really looked at her, and she pushed her thumbs into his eyes, making Myrna Shepherd's ethereal face the last thing he saw even as he came inside her. When she finally spoke to him, it was through a crackle of static that masked her voice.
"Is there anything better than this?"
"No,"
he said, and meant it. Now that he was blind, he could truly see his goddess for what she was, and she owned him body and soul because of that.
"Worship me,"
he did, with blind devotion. 11. The Angel. Josh Raines read Isaiah's letter again, for the second time that day, looking for answers. He had been wrong. There were addresses in it. Boundary Street, or as it had been, Cock Lane, Spitalfields, Friar's Mount. But there was one that seemed to stand out, because it was more than just a street. It was a building, too. The Peabody in Rotherhithe from Hitchcock's unfinished Number 13. All roads led to Rotherhithe. It was late, getting on for midnight. Cross-city traffic wasn't the best. The last underground had already rolled through, and he wasn't about to walk all the way to Rotherhithe. But he couldn't go home, either. Not while that thing was still out there. A chill ran down the ladder of his spine, as he thought about the white wraith with Shepherd's face, and those haunting, static-filled recitations that spewed from her mouth. Things were happening. Things he didn't like and didn't understand. Reading Isaiah's letter just left him with more questions. But if there were answers to be found, then maybe, just maybe, he had the key. The only way to find out was to go to Rotherhithe and see for himself. The candle had burned down to a stub while he'd been reading. He snuffed it out,
leaving the shed in darkness. He didn't know anything about Hitchcock. He had no idea if the Peabody had been a real building, or if they'd used the facade of some old warehouse down by the waterfront to double as the low-income housing project from the movie. And if they had, what were the chances that it would still be there now, and not have been converted into some luxury apartments for city boys with more money than sense? Even 5 or 6 years ago, it would have been next to impossible to find anything before sunrise. That was just the way it was. A decade ago, a mobile phone could barely even be called that. At worst, it was a brick. It certainly wasn't smart. But now he had access to all the information in the world in his pocket. All he had to do was sift through it. Hitchcock was a public figure, and even a lost film of his had to be the stuff of film legend, surely. There were people out there who were experts on this stuff, and he had access to them without having to leave the shed. Josh used his phone to sift through the hits his search returned. Within a minute, he was looking at a grainy black-and-white behind-the-scenes still of Claire Greets and her leading man, Ernest Thesiger. They sat on the steps of what he hoped was the Peabody building from Number 13. It appeared to be an intersection in Rotherhithe, but it was hard to really see any details, and there were no real landmarks to speak of to help him get his bearings. There was a set of high steps leading up to the door, while the footpath curved around the portico of a shop. No, he realized, studying the tiny image. It wasn't a shop. The signage read, The Ang. The rest of the name invisible as it curved around the facade. He could only think of one kind of establishment that had a the like that in their name. A public house. The Angel. The Anglers. Assuming the place hadn't been torn down during the intervening years, or flattened during the Blitz, there couldn't be that many pubs in Rotherhithe with the Ang in their name, could there? There was only one way to find out. Josh eased the shed door closed behind him, and used a broken stone to hold it shut. He checked his watch. His mum would be getting back to the house soon. He really should go home to make sure she was okay, and at the very least warn her what she was walking into. He couldn't imagine how it'd feel finding her entire life turned out all over the floor, on the day she buried one of the two men left in her life. But he couldn't go home, and calling her to tell her what was waiting for her, rather than doing it in person, standing side by side with her as she surveyed the damage, felt somehow cowardly. So he called his sister, Alexandra, Lexi. She picked up on the second ring. No hello, just a barked,
Where the fuck are you?
The emphasis heavily on the fuck. Josh didn't even try and deflect the question. He ignored it completely and told her,
Sis, I need you to go home with Mum. Don't let her go home alone. Promise me.
There was silence at the other end of the line. He could hear the cogs in her mind grinding.
What's going on?
What did he tell her? The answer was obvious. As little as possible. Nothing if he could get away with it.
Please, just promise me. Don't let her go back by herself.
What's going on, bro? You sound weird.
I am weird, he said.
He wanted to say that he was good, everything was fine, but he didn't.
There's been a break-in. The place is a state. The police are here. I don't want her going back there alone. She doesn't need it tonight.
Christ! What kind of a sick cocksniff robs someone when they're at a fucking funeral?
Welcome to the Rothery. You've been gone too long. She breathed in sharply.
Okay, I'll keep her away from there.
Another hesitation. Then she asked,
You aren't trying to find them, are you?
She knew him too well. But then that was brothers and sisters the world over, wasn't it?
Promise me you're not doing something stupid, Josh.
Promise, he said, and they both knew he was lying.
I don't believe you.
I don't expect you to. I'll be home soon. Don't worry. It's going to be fine.
He killed the call before she made him tell her any more lies. He walked out of the vegetable gardens, back up the muddy hill, and eventually back out onto the main road. The streetlights weren't working in this part of the estate, and several cars were almost invisible in the darkness because of it. But unlike a lot of his neighbors, Josh had never nurtured the necessary skills that would have allowed him to drive off in one of them without the key. He kept his head down and walked back toward the edge of the Rothery, hoping to flag down a passing taxi. The night was bracing. He felt the sting of the wind on his face and wished he were better dressed. But at least it wasn't raining. Kids far too young to be out at this time of night loitered on the street corner, hands stuffed in pockets, heads down, feet scuffing the pavement. There were half a dozen of them with lightning bolts and other decals shaved into their scalps, like the urban equivalent of a peacock's feathers. A couple of them eyed Josh suspiciously, but none of them moved. On a normal night, they would have been intimidating. Tonight, though, was anything but normal. They looked exactly like what they were. Kids. He passed near enough to overhear what they were saying, but it sounded like a foreign language to him. It would take ages to walk to Bermondsey, but he had nowhere else to go. The Rothery was a warren of streets that all fed back toward the green, the hunter's horns, and the lightning-struck tree in its heart. Getting out of it felt like a rat trying to work its way back out of a maze after it had snaffled the cheese, something that wasn't meant to happen. A pair of trainers hung from the arms of one of the lampposts. It wasn't quite L.A. with the trainer strung up to mark fallen gang members, more like a bully who decided to make some kid's life hell for a morning. Josh passed a dozen boarded-up windows. Some of the houses had been left empty after a fire in the summer had gutted them. The bricks around the windows were still blackened with soot. There were cars up on bricks where their wheels had been spirited away. England, my England, this green and pleasant land, Josh thought as he crossed the road and made his way toward the real world outside the Rothery. He saw the back of a red night bus cross the mouth of the housing estate in front of him, and the light indicating that it was pulling in. He ran after it, barely reaching the doors before the driver could close them in his face and drive off. Josh paid his fare and made the journey as far as Tower Hill, with the drunks and the damned, that entire subculture of London that only came out at night. He sat upstairs at the back and spent the best part of an hour gazing out of the window. At one point he found himself staring at two young goths in the relative seclusion of an overgrown cemetery. It took him a moment to realize that they were fucking up against one of the gravestones, while across the street a guy filled his car with petrol from the all-night garage. If he'd been a philosopher, Josh might have drawn some kind of conclusions from the juxtaposition, but he wasn't looking for the ties that bind. He just wanted to get to Rotherhithe. He rested his forehead against the glass, feeling the vibrations of the old bus as it rumbled down the potholed road. Drunks stumbled up the stairs, drunks stumbled down the stairs, and the only thing they left behind them was the stench of kebabs. A group of Chinese tourists looked less than impressed in their corporate windbreakers. They talked among themselves animatedly, their voices like birdsong. Josh liked listening to languages he couldn't understand. Without the structure of words and knowing where one ended and another began, the sounds became musical. It didn't take him long to get caught up in the rise and fall and rise of their strange tongue, to the point that he almost missed his stop. He thanked the driver out of habit and stepped off the bus into the shadow of the tower. Rather than try and find a connection, he started to walk around the back of the tourist attraction, toward perhaps the most famous bridge in the world, and cross the river. There were so many songs about the city, from Waterloo Sunset, which was still a few hours away, to Baker Street and London Calling. And walking across the water, it was easy to see what it was about the place that inspired so many artists. He caught himself trying to hum at least half a dozen of them, without actually knowing the tunes well enough for anyone to distinguish one from the next. But it put a smile on his face for the first time in what felt like forever, and helped pass the half an hour it took to walk to Bermondsey. Now that he was there, he didn't know where to start looking. It wasn't exactly a small borough, but given every reference to number 13 mentioned Rotherhithe, not Bermondsey, it was safe to assume he could head down to the end of the Jamaica Road and start looking from there. Jamaica Road could have been any inner-city road in England. It had the same red brick snakes of terraced houses, with the downstairs converted to shops and restaurants. All of the shop fronts covered by roller shutters. The roller shutters in turn covered by fly posters for upcoming concerts in and around the town. It was a concrete and steel version of the old woman who swallowed a fly and didn't know what to do. There was no one on the street, but unlike the Rothery, Josh didn't feel like he was taking his life in his hands venturing out alone. Soon enough he had crossed through Southwark Park and King's Stairs Gardens and reached the roundabout at the end of Jamaica Road. He was confronted by choices as he stood facing the water. It wasn't just a simple case of eeny meeny, left, right, or straight down to the waterfront either. Yes, there were three main streets in front of him, but within 100 feet those three streets became 7, and 100 feet after that those 7 became 19, as Neptune Street, Albion Street, and Brunel Road fed into the Norwegian Mission and the Finnish Church, and a warren of courts and estates all the way to Surrey Water. A man could get lost trying to track them all street by street, he realized, confronted with the reality of trying to do a pre-dawn grid search of the place. There were too many places to get turned around. He decided to start down by the water, for no better reason than it meant there was a clean dead end he could keep returning to as he worked his way along the riverbank. Josh followed the path down the side of the King's Stairs Gardens, which were a vast field of black out of the reach of the streetlights. He could make out a few outcroppings of stone that appeared to be some sort of ruin that had been half excavated. A boat out on the Thames sounded its horn. It had to be one of the most melancholic sounds of the city, encapsulating the loneliness of so many of the people who lived in London in one forlorn note. After a couple of minutes, Josh found himself face to face with the Angel Pub, which stood all alone against the backdrop of the Thames. Even isolated from all of the workhouses and other buildings that had been in the grainy photograph with it, Josh knew he was standing in the exact same place Hitchcock had stood when the photographer had taken the photograph of Claire Greet and Ernest Thesinger on the steps. There was something wonderful about that, the way it connected one place and two times. Not, he realized, that it helped. None of those old buildings were still standing, so any hope of walking up to a door and finding the Peabody, or some other clue left like a trail of breadcrumbs by Boone, came crashing down with them. He took a moment to really take in his surroundings. Aside from the lonely public house, there was a terrace of what appeared to be dock workers' tenements on the far side of the green. There was a fairly modern block of apartments, or offices, it was difficult to tell, and of course the railed-off section of the Bermondsey Wall excavations. All in all, not very much. He walked across the street to check out the pub. The sign beside the door told the story of the old building, claiming it had stood in the same place for over 500 years, and hosted the likes of Samuel Pepys, Captain James Cook before his journey to Australia, and Christopher Jones, captain of the Mayflower, who hired his crew from inside the Angel. The place fairly reeked of history. There was mention of an old priory, and how the monks themselves had brewed the ale for the Angel. Behind the pub was a stretch of land known as Cuckold's Point, where the corpses of river pirates had been strung up as a deterrent to the rest of their kind. It was also the starting point for the riotous Horn Fair, where the mores were discarded for the day, and women especially could surrender themselves to indecency and immodesty, while the men drank and fucked with merry abandon. The legend was that King John himself had given the land to a miller he cuckolded after a hunting trip. That certainly set the tone for the wild fair. There was no mention of a place called Glasstown, no images of glassblowers or anything else to do with fashioning glass or optics or lenses, nothing that might have linked the place to Isaiah's letter, and nothing to suggest Hitchcock's career had begun, if falteringly, on this very spot. Josh didn't need to close his eyes to imagine the press gangs working the waterfront, and the old wharves or the women dancing with wild abandon, drunk on laughter and lust. There had been so much life here, and the Blitz had left it a wasteland. Yet the Angel survived. The pub was locked up tight for the night. Josh did a circuit around the building, walking the same steps those condemned pirates must have walked to the gallows, but despite the slightly unnerving thought, it offered no clues. There was nothing that screamed out Boone. He was beginning to doubt himself, or his late-night reasoning at least, but before he gave up entirely and went back home, Josh decided to check one last thing. He walked back around the edge of the Priory land, following the rusted railings to the workers' cottages. He opted to start there because that row of houses offered the most possibilities, or at least he hoped they did. They were the only buildings that could reasonably have been around when Hitchcock filmed Number 13. He was clinging to that, but somehow it all came back to the film. Otherwise, why would Isaiah have made a point of mentioning it at all? The first thing he looked for was a Number 13, but he was never going to be that lucky. There were 12 doors on the street, and all of their numbers were even. That was typically English, too, a conspiracy to confuse the hell out of the postal workers. In the absence of a 13, he looked for something else to hang his hopes on, another clue that might have led back to Hitchcock or his family. Josh half expected to hear sirens after a few minutes. He couldn't have looked more suspicious if he tried, moving from door to door, checking them, and then moving on to the next. But it was late enough that even the nosiest neighbor was asleep. Each of the doors had buzzers, each buzzer seemingly calling multiple occupancies. Most had names that meant nothing to him. Most. There was one, in the middle of the street, that was more than just a little familiar. It said, Lockwood. More precisely, it said, Isaiah Lockwood. It took him a second to realize what was wrong with that, and that second was all he needed to be sure he was in the right place. Isaiah must have secured the place before he changed his name, or used his real name to hide it from his brother, Seth, or Boone had, and chosen to hide behind his father's real name. This was it, he realized, Boone's secret place. Once he opened the door, there could be no going back. Everything that had obsessed his great-grandfather and consumed his life was on the other side of the door. Josh had the key out of his pocket and in the lock before any second thoughts could stop him. The key turned in the lock. The door opened. He went inside. 12. Timeless Beauty. Isaiah Lockwood, whoever he may be, owned an upstairs flat. The narrow hall had that distinctly damp smell of abandonment. Josh turned on the light. A bare bulb burned too brightly after the darkness, sizzling. He closed the door behind him. The stairs rose steeply, the outsides of the runners whitewashed, the inside bare floorboards. It had obviously been carpeted once. Now the only carpet was one of ignored flyers, special offers, takeaway menus, and discount coupons that covered the floor completely. He picked a path to the stairs and climbed them. Upstairs was no better. As his mum was fond of saying, it looked like a bomb had hit it. But where the aftermath of a bomb was chaos, there was a madman's order to the mess here. Josh walked into what had obviously been intended by the architect to be the lounge. It was utterly devoid of anything that could remotely be called furniture. It wasn't empty, though. It was full of crazy, as far as Josh could tell. Every inch of the place was covered in newspaper cuttings, with color-coded threads strung from one to the next, strings stretched from wall to wall, crisscrossing the room like a loom. He saw headlines from familiar papers like The Standard, Daily Mail, and The Times, to ones he'd never heard of where the presses had long since stopped turning, the Westminster Gazette, the London Daily News, and a mix of informers and ledgers and advertisers that catalogued London life from the 20s all the way through to the turn of the century. The old papers were so much more crammed with words, as though they could barely contain all of the stories they were trying to tell, than the more modern ones. They weren't all about the disappearance of Eleanor Raines, either, but plenty were, chronicling the investigation and the frustration at the lack of evidence it unearthed, suspicion gradually coming around to Isaiah, the jilted lover, with the lack of anyone else to blame. Josh couldn't absorb it all in one cursory glance. It would take some serious reading to digest everything gathered in this room. Suspects' names came and went, some like Jack Sykes appearing over and over, then suddenly never appearing again, while others were mentioned only once, instantly forgettable. Some of the threads, he realized, seemed to be charting sightings of Eleanor after her disappearance, and there were finds, too. Bodies of unfortunate women they thought were her but weren't. For a while there, every corpse in London was Eleanor Raines. It was as though the press were willing her to be dead rather than just gone, like it would have been a better story for them. Which, of course, it would have been. A dead actress would sell more papers than a missing one. Stay gone long enough, and the world forgot you were there in the first place. But turn up murdered, and you would never be forgotten. As difficult as it was, Josh turned his back on her story and moved across to one of the other walls. This one couldn't have been more different if it tried. It was filled with weird drawings of Celtic knots and green-leafed faces, images of stone circles and dolmen, some huge like Stonehenge, others tiny like the fairy ring in Coldfall Wood. There were maps of ley lines and all sorts of endless knots of what might have been occult paraphernalia. He really couldn't tell. He saw words scrawled in a language he couldn't read, and others, like old earth magic, that he could. They were repeated all over the wall. There was one word he'd never seen before. Anwen. And beside it a question. The land of the dead? Among the paragraphs of crossed-out research, he saw the words primeval forest, and another drawing of the fairy ring like the one in Coldfall Wood. There were other drawings of chalk giants. It all seemed so out of place against the rest of it, which was so mundane by comparison. An entire section was given over to gangland feuds between the Lockwoods and various East End families. Much of it was just bloody knuckles dishing out back-alley beatings, a proper 20s turf war, with the kind of trademark brutality that would have gone down well in the Chicago of the same era, judging by the reports. Skimming the headlines and the story leads for the meat, Josh learned a lot about his great-grandfather's family and the brutal extremes they had gone to when they took over the streets. It wasn't pretty, but then very little had changed, had it? Beside the papers was an array of fly posters for Damiola, Lord of Illusions, with grand claims promising to confound the mind and delight the heart. His illusions included self-decapitation, levitation, talking with the spirits of fallen soldiers, and mystifying legerdemain in a theatre of wonder. In the centre, one poster boldly proclaimed, "Witness the wondrous Opticron! Watch as it opens windows into fabulous new worlds. Marvel at the miraculous sights it has to show you. You cannot believe your eyes." And again beside that new world's promise, he saw the handwritten question, "Anwen?" Beside that one word was a photograph of the Lord of Illusions himself, a very smug-looking Damiola. It was quite the juxtaposition against the mythologies and crime reports on the other wall. There were maps, too, old-fashioned street maps from the 1890s and 1920s, with the same area ringed in red. And then there were other maps, and it just wasn't there anymore, like the cartographers had erased it, and joined the ragged seams it left behind to mask its disappearance. His head was spinning with it all. There must have been 1,000 articles cut out and pasted up on the walls, covered with the same barely literate scrawl, which he took to be Isaiah's, but some no doubt were the result of Boone adding to his father's obsessive detailing of the crime. He found a name in red marker, Reuben Glass. It stood out because Isaiah had mentioned him in his letter. Josh worked his way around the walls quickly, scanning the articles as he went, but at first glance he couldn't find any other mention of Reuben Glass. But of course there were other rooms, and Isaiah's confession had promised him all of the answers. What had he called him? The King of Glasstown? Perhaps the link was to the organized crime detailed on the other wall, the Lockwood Purge. But there were no colored threads for him to follow back there, though, so maybe that wasn't it. Maybe he was linked to Hitchcock or the actress Claire Greet. Isaiah had mentioned her, too. If there were answers, it would take time to find them in here. That much was obvious. The second bedroom was no better either, though it did at least have a single piece of furniture, an old cinema projector resting on an East India Company tea chest. The East India Company had ceased trading over 150 years ago. The right someone would no doubt have considered the tea chest a treasure. There was a single canister on the floor beside the tea chest. The reel of film was already in the projector, which faced the only wall in the entire flat that wasn't covered in cuttings documenting Isaiah Lockwood's obsessive search for his beloved Eleanor. And then, of course, there was the shrine to Eleanor, otherwise known as the master bedroom. Her face was everywhere, over every inch of the wall. Publicity stills, candid shots, newspaper cuttings, just thousands upon thousands of photographs of her. This was the room Isaiah slept in, surrounded by her face. There was a mattress on the floor in the corner, and the sweat-stained sheet that hadn't been washed since it had been bought covering it. Josh stood in the middle of the room trying to look at the pictures all at once. There was no doubting she was an incredibly beautiful woman, but there was something about them that didn't feel right. He couldn't put his finger on it. He stared and stared, turning and turning about, taking them all in, every angle of her beautiful face. Eleanor Raines had been blessed. The camera loved her. It didn't matter if the images were candid or posed, color, sepia or black and white. Her bone structure and perfect porcelain skin was the stuff of Max Factor dreams. But it was her eyes that transformed the photographs into art. There was so much pain in them. This was a woman who understood loss. That was unexpected. Whoever had assembled the shrine had gone to pains to cut out all of the accompanying texts, and considering her brief time in the sun, this room quite possibly collected every single photograph ever taken of Eleanor Raines. The bedroom was decorated with one man's obsession. And then he realized what it was that jarred in his mind. Some of the photographs just didn't look old enough. Josh walked up to the wall, peeling one of the newer-looking ones away. The date and timestamp on it, added digitally, claimed that the shot had been taken 19 years ago, 1994. He'd seen that date before, on Isaiah's letter. That didn't make any sense. Eleanor Raines would have been pushing her mid-90s by the time that photograph had been taken, but the woman looking back at him was young. He would have thought it was some kind of mistake, that the photograph had actually been taken from an existing negative of something that was much older, but for the fact that people in the background were dressed very much in 90s fashion. One clutched a pre-CFC-free polystyrene burger box from McDonald's. Josh was pretty sure that the backdrop of heart attack burgers and fries weren't pre-1924. He recognized Spitalfields Market. Josh took Isaiah's confession from his pocket and skimmed through it again, looking for one paragraph in particular.
I saw her yesterday. It was a crowded street around Spitalfields. She stepped out of a narrow, grotty little alleyway, turned, saw me, but didn't recognize this grizzled old face of mine, because time is such a feckless bastard and makes husks of us all. She disappeared into the crowd before I could catch up with her. I don't know what I would have said even if I had. I can't even be sure it was her. It might have been the weight of decades of grief on my soul, the burden of all that longing manifesting itself in her presence, because she hadn't changed. Not in the slightest.
And here it was in a photograph, the proof of that letter. She hadn't changed. He looked at Eleanor Raines's face, captured in 1994 by some photographer's camera lens, and knew it was true. She hadn't changed in the slightest. It was exactly the same face as the one in the photographs from 70 years earlier. Exactly. Like she wasn't a day older. He had no idea how that was possible. 1994. He checked the letter again. Isaiah had written his confession in January that year, and died soon after. This photograph was from January 1994. He'd written that she hadn't recognized him. But what if it wasn't a coincidence that he'd seen her right before the end? What if she'd somehow found a way to come back to see him one last time? On any other night, he would have castigated himself for letting his imagination run away with itself. But hadn't he just walked in on Myrna Shepherd in his grandfather's bedroom? Didn't that mean anything was possible? Another photograph caught his eye. It took him a moment to realize what he was looking at. His first impression was of Eleanor standing in the rain. It took a little longer for the context of the image to settle in. It was a beautiful shot, of course, haunting in its simplicity. The woman silhouetted against the backdrop of broken angels and mausoleums, but that wasn't what drew his eye to it. She stood with her head bowed beside a grave. He couldn't read the writing on the headstone, but recognized it nonetheless. It was in the old Bun Hill Field Cemetery, famous as the resting place of Bunyan, Defoe, the comedian Al Clamp, and a smattering of Cromwell's. He recognized the gravestone because he'd visited it before. It was Isaiah's. So there was a photograph of a woman who was a dead ringer for Eleanor Raines, at the graveside of the man who, after being accused of her murder, had spent his entire adult life obsessed with discovering the truth about her disappearance. It was hard to believe that it was just a coincidence. It was hard to believe that anything was a coincidence now. It was as though the world around him was actually a fractured mosaic, that there were cracks that broke the pattern and made it difficult to see how things connected. But cracked or not, that didn't mean they didn't connect somewhere, somehow. Josh left the shrine and went back through to the room of crazy, with all of its cuttings and colored threads, and took up a place in the middle of it all. It was only then, standing on top of it, that he noticed the damage to the floorboards. He hadn't noticed it before because of the thick layer of dust. They had been scored and scorched over and over again, but not like someone had tried to start a fire. The damage was much more precise than that. It gradually dawned on Josh that it wasn't damage at all, but rather a drawing. He dropped to his knees and began brushing the dust back to reveal the image it hid. Someone had scored a map of a part of London into the floor. The reason he hadn't recognized it for what it was initially was that it was wrong. Even the curve of the Thames was off. There was an entire borough between the landmarks of Spitalfields, Aldgate, and Shadwell that just wasn't there in the real world. Was this the mysterious glass town Isaiah had written about? Closer inspection and more frantic brushing with his bare hands revealed 13 curious indentations in the wood, as though a knife had been dragged back and forth across them repeatedly to make its mark, but only for an inch or so in either direction. The strokes were neat, and the same on each of the 13 points, but their distribution across the map wasn't even, or seemingly logical. Beside them, someone had carved three words, 141, deep into the floorboards, scoring over the letters again and again to be sure they'd never fade. The first O was within Coldfall Wood, over what would have been the old fairy ring, he thought. Josh tried to place the rest of the indentations in the real world, but he wasn't all that familiar with the area, certainly not well enough to pinpoint the corresponding places without a map. But of course he had a map. He had lots of them up on the wall, some with the red-ringed area that had to be Glasstown marked on them, others without. He started to check them against each other, trying to picture where exactly these deep-scored marks referred to in the cityscape he knew from almost 30 years of living inside it. But it just didn't fit. Not in any meaningful way. He couldn't join the dots. It was as though a part of London had been excised, and the only proof that it had ever existed at all was plastered all over these walls. Could people simply forget somewhere existed? Could they be made to forget? He looked up from the floorboards to see the smug face of Damiola, Lord of Illusions, looking down at him. That look seemed to say, yes, yes they could, if you knew the trick. But even if they could, it wasn't as though an entire warren of streets could simply disappear without a trace, was it? It wasn't like a ship going missing inside the Bermuda Triangle. Streets were physically rooted to the earth. The ground couldn't creep over them and bury them away without a trace. Rip them out of the city, and surely they would leave behind a physical wound where they had been. Cartographers could erase them from maps, sure. Any line that could be drawn could be erased, but that didn't take those streets away from the city proper. There was no all-seeing architect who could rearrange the geography of London to hide an entire neighborhood. The world didn't work like that. 141. There was no magic powerful enough to make it happen that wasn't conjured by books or films or computer games. In other words, there was no magic, no matter how hard men like Damiola try to convince you otherwise, no matter how many endless knots or horned gods or green men he drew. That was the brutally mundane reality of it all. The world was going to work, coming home from work, sitting in offices, staring out of windows, dreaming of something bigger, something wonderful, even magical, as you begged strangers to pay thousands of pounds to place glossy ads and clever copy in a dying medium. But that was all it ever was, a dream. Nevertheless, there was no getting around the fact that Myrna Shepherd had broken into his house tonight. That wasn't a dream. But that didn't make it magic, either. 13. Number 13. There was food in the fridge, but he wasn't sure he could trust any of it not to poison him. Everything in there had a jaundiced hue. There was a jar of instant coffee on the counter, though, surrounded by a scattering of granules that Boone hadn't cleared away. It wasn't exactly manna from heaven, but it would do for now. Josh boiled the kettle and made a too-hot brew before going back to the projection room, cradling the cup in his hands. How many hours had his grandfather spent in this place during his life? It was hard to imagine Boone's secret life, but there was no escaping the fact that the old man must have been living one. It was like discovering he'd been living with a spy all these years. Josh closed the door behind him. He liked closed doors. They gave the illusion of safety. The film reel was already in the projector. All he needed to do was plug the machine in and flick the switch to turn it on. The motor hummed slightly alarmingly as he did, and a dust-filled light speared the wall. The reel clicked as the film was drawn between the lens and the light, and the images began to flicker unsteadily across the wall. There was no title sequence or anything else that he would have associated with a movie. But of course he was looking at something that had never been finished. Something the rest of the world thought was lost. Raw footage from Hitchcock's Number 13. That the projector started at all was testament to the fact that someone had been paying the bills for this secret place. There was no sound, so Josh had to try and guess what the story was meant to be. Even without the sound, though, he found himself being caught up in the facial expressions and body language, and realized there was a fundamental truth to the story he was interpreting, and that without words it was harder to lie. There was a life lesson in that, he realized, watching the rough cut. 2 minutes in, Josh recognized the pub across the street from where he was now. But everything else was new, or rather old, lost to the German bombs and the avaricious developers who had moved into the area. Every now and again he caught a glimpse of Eleanor Raines in the background, but she never seemed to be the center of any shots. She was instantly recognizable, though, because her face was plastered all over the walls around the makeshift screen. He watched the way she moved. He watched the way she inclined her head. He watched the way her lips twitched as she smiled. And in all of those things, he could see exactly why she'd stolen Isaiah's heart so completely and utterly. She came alive in the moving pictures in a way that she just didn't in the stills. It was as though the film had caught part of her essence that stills just couldn't, no matter how wonderfully they were lit or how perfectly her makeup was applied. And even then she was never the center of attention. She didn't need to be. She smoldered, drawing the eye no matter where she was in the shot. One thing caught his attention early on in the film. A poster for Damiola pasted to the wall of a crumbling tenement. He recognized it immediately, because the same poster was on the wall in the other room. The fact it was